If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Welcome to Scylla Consciousness, the DSR Network podcast focusing on the artificial intelligence revolution, politics, and policy.
Hello and welcome to one of the very first episodes of Scylla Consciousness, our podcast focusing on the intersection of AI, policy, and politics. We thought it would be completely appropriate to kick things off with a discussion with a friend, Paul Shari, who's the Executive Vice President and Director of Studies at CNAS. He's the award-winning author of 4 Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, one of the very, very best thinkers on these subjects that we know anywhere. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been busy over there since the last time we spoke. And so I thought the place I would begin is looking at a couple of your recent projects. I saw an article by you in Foreign Affairs earlier this year, and I want to touch on that and then move on to a bigger subject. This was the perilous coming of age of AI warfare, how to limit the threat of autonomous weapons. We've talked about this on one of our other podcasts, but I wanted to pick up on it so that we could also discuss it here, because the issue of killing machines that decide who to kill, is alarming to a lot of people, particularly if the speed of advances outpace the speed of people to keep up with them. The article came out in February. Since then, what's changed in this world?
Well, as you said, the technology is moving forward very, very quickly. I was actually just in Ukraine a few weeks ago talking with drone developers as well as their military about how they're using, among other things, AI and autonomy in their drones. And so one of the things that we're seeing play out in the battlefield is, as in Ukraine, for example, we've seen this huge explosion in the use of drones. That, of course, has led to counter-drone techniques, including jamming, to go after the communications link between the drone and the human operator. And that, in turn, is now leading towards more pressure for autonomy. And so already on the front lines right now is being tested autonomous terminal guidance. So this would be the ability to, the human chooses the target, and then the drone locks onto a target and can maneuver in for the final attack, totally free of human involvement, even if there's a jamming situation that occurs that cuts off the communications link. Now, that's not a fully autonomous weapon, but it's yet another baby step in that direction. And when you contrast that with the speed of diplomacy on these issues, it's a very stark contrast.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the speed of diplomacy, because that's constrained somewhat by the speed of diplomats getting up to speed with their comprehension of these issues. As you explain in the article, one of the reasons that these autonomous technologies have caught on is that the ability to shut off their comms is the way that they're currently being stopped. Now, if they can move without that, you actually have to knock out the drone. You've talked about that, too. I saw an article in which you were talking about directed energy weapons instead of missiles. Why are they better?
So one of the challenges right now in terms of defending against drones is it's not enough to just shoot down the drone. You need a defense that is cost effective. So if you shoot down a $1,000 drone with a $1 million missile, every time you're losing. And one of the things we've seen in Ukraine is this proliferation of very cheap drones on both sides. And in fact, the in some cases, the cost of shooting it down with, say, an expensive missile is just so costly. For Ukraine, for example, the number of air defense missiles they have is very scarce. And they need to save those on high-priority targets, so they're not even using them against cheap drones. So one of the things that's appealing about directed energy, and when we say directed energy, we're meaning instead of a physical projectile, like a bullet, that goes out and intersects with something, or a missile that impacts on a target, it's a beam of energy. That could be a laser. It could be electromagnetic energy in the form of radio frequency that could be used for jamming or to disrupt electronics or high-powered microwaves. So it's this very broad kind of category, directed energy. But what's appealing about this is that, in theory, if you have enough power to the system, and if you designed it a certain way, you could have infinite magazine depth. So what do you mean by that? Well, let's talk about a ship, for example. Ships have surface-to-air missiles. They can shoot down incoming threats, but eventually they're going to run out of missiles, and it's not easy for a ship to get more missiles. They got to go all the way back to port. If you have a laser weapon on that ship, as long as it's got continuous power, you could just keep shooting down incoming threats. Now, that's the theory. In practice, this is really, really hard physics to get this done, but that's the goal of directed energy.
Do you ever stop and say, wait a minute, I'm talking about death rays versus killer robots? You know, it's so directly in the zone of, 1920s science fiction that it's kind of remarkable to believe that it's, or to reckon with the fact that it's actually here.
Well, it is pretty wild. And, the U.S. government doesn't like the term death rays or killer robots. But it is, sometimes when you do think about the technology, it's remarkable. It's scary at times. I think it's, particularly in the AI space, we've seen so many advances in just the past few years that it is striking to me. I mean, I've been working on these issues for the last 15 years or so, and I am still surprised by the pace of advancement of the technology.
Well, that brings me to the other thing that I wanted to make sort of the center of our discussion. You have produced at the Center for New American Security, something called Future Proofing Frontier AI Regulation. This came out in March, and it looks at the challenges of governments coping with advances that are as rapid as you describe. The opening of the report really just illustrates in really stark terms, how quickly we go from, GPT-4, which, we sort of discovered a year ago, to 1,000 times that in a couple of years, and what the consequences of that are. Let's break it out. We'll get to consequences in a second, particularly the challenges for policymakers. Talk about the speed of these developments right now.
Sure. So let's start with the numbers, because they're pretty striking here. I think people might have an intuitive sense that AI is moving forward quickly, but it is, in fact, in a quantitative sense, moving forward at a very, very fast pace. So right now, the amount of computing power that's being used to train the most advanced AI systems like GPT-4 or equivalent systems by other companies is doubling every 6 months. That is a very, very fast rate of growth, and that's much faster than what we've seen over the last several decades under Moore's Law, where chip performance doubled roughly every 2 years. So that's what's leading to these rapid scales of these systems using tens of thousands of the most advanced chips in the world. And what the report does is basically just take the best data that we have on the current trends and project them forward until you start to run into some obstacles in cost or hardware or other things. And the bottom line conclusion is that we could see AI models that are trained on 1 million times as much effective computing power as GPT-4 by 2030. That's right around the corner. And that's, now, what is that going to do? I don't know. But the argument is that that's the future we need to prepare for.
But one of the things you talk about, though, in your description of this at the beginning of the piece, is that that's not all, folks. You know, that that there's also the issue of algorithmic efficiency, and that as people figure out how to develop more elegant algorithms, that they can make better use of that million times more power, right?
Right. So there's a couple things happening. One is that the amount of computing power that's used to train these systems is doubling, and that's partly due to improvements in the chips themselves, and partly due to people spending more money and buying more chips. So in the future, you've got better chips, you've got more chips, and you've got improvements in the algorithms. And when you combine all three of those, that's where you get to a million times more effective computing power. So I'm using the term effective computing power sort of to mean the combination of the chips and the better algorithms that allow you to get more out of those chips.
Yeah, I once tabulated this, and I won't go into the details, but if you take the computing power of the average human brain and you multiply it by these higher speed chips, you get to something like, within the next couple of years, 10 million times the average human brain, which is, you know, the population of England at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You know, so you've got in, I mean, obviously it's not an apples and apples comparison, but you're getting to the point where you've got the processing power in one of these chips equivalent to a fairly large advanced country. I mean, you know, in human beings working without the benefit of technology.
Well, and I think that points to some of the potential here of the technology, and for good or bad, when you think about things like job displacement and economic productivity, which is to say that once you've trained an AI model that can perform some kind of task, it doesn't have to be everything that humans could do, but it can some subset of things that people can do in front of a computer that are economically valuable, you can then copy that model and have lots of copies running on different chips. And the amount of computing power that's used to train these models is very high. It's very computationally intensive. But then once the model itself has been trained, it can be run with much less computing power. And so you can have many copies of them running, and they can execute tasks very, very quickly. So again, we're not at the place where the AI systems can replace humans wholesale for the types of tasks that humans do, but we are seeing them increasingly become relevant for white-collar job kind of work, which I think is going to be very transformative to economic productivity in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah, and different. Past leaps forward in productivity have tended to have an effect on people at the bottom of the economic food chain. Now we're entering a period where it's radiologists, it's lawyers, it's teachers, it's translators, it's architects. You know, it's a group of people who have white-collar jobs that they spend a lot of money going to college for, who can be, you know, you don't say you're going to replace people wholesale, but a lot of them can be displaced. The need for the number of them an organization may have may go down somewhat. That's got a political consequence as well as a simple labor market consequence. And we've never seen that before.
Yeah, we don't really know. I mean, I think there's a lot of possibilities in terms of what this could look like going forward. Certainly, you can draw a straight line, really, from the systems we have today to ones that are able to do maybe a good chunk of the things that people can do in front of a computer. Because already top-of-the-line AI systems can achieve human-level performance on the GRE, at various AP tests, SAT exam, bar exam, and they can, you know, do things like navigate the web and gain information, and you can write scripts that they can then use productivity tools like Word and Excel. And people are taking these models and linking them together into a system to perform various tasks. So in the near term, the contest is going to be between really people that are effective at using these tools and those that aren't, and that start to fall behind. But in the long run, it's just not clear. I mean, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, it took really, you know, the primary type of economic work that people had, farming, completely out of the labor force. That's now a tiny, tiny fraction of what people do, but it created new jobs. And so that could be one future where a lot of the things that people are doing, we don't do in the future, but there's new jobs and they're good jobs and that's fine. On the other hand, the Industrial Revolution put horses out of business and the horse population in America plummeted. And so, you know, the sort of scary world is that we're kind of like the horse, and you could see a future, not tomorrow, but maybe down the road, where human labor is just not very valuable.
One of the things I appreciate about your analyses is your humility in making them. There are a lot of people out there who make these statements. Oh, don't worry. There will definitely be new jobs. Everybody's going to be fine. But they don't know that. And, you know, this report that you wrote, which I encourage people to go read at the CNES site, is about future-proofing AI regulation. And, you know, when there was the conference earlier this year in England about AI safety, and there was a lot of talk about frontier AI. There in the executive order that the White House put out, there's a lot of talk about frontier AI. But every time I read the word frontier AI, what I see is, you know, TBD. We don't know what this is. There are things that could happen, and we don't know what these things are, but we really better be prepared for them. And that's kind of the core challenge you're dealing with, isn't it? This podcast is underwritten in part by the U.S. Embassy of the United Arab Emirates. Its editorial content is completely independent, and the views expressed are exclusively those of participating experts. It is presented live without editing. For further information about the UAE's efforts in the areas of artificial intelligence and technology, go to the website of the embassy at www.uae-embassy.org and search for UAE-US Tech Cooperation. We thank them for their support. We thank everybody who's supporting this podcast for their support, and we look forward to it developing and growing over time because the issue is so important.
Yeah, and maybe it's worth unpacking this idea of frontier AI a little bit and why is this an issue? So older model AI systems going back last several decades were rule-based systems where you built a machine to solve some kind of task by writing down a set of rules for how you wanted that machine to perform. So for example, you wanted a machine that could play chess. And this is how IBM created Deep Blue in the 90s, to beat Garry Kasparov at chess, talking to chess grandmasters, writing on a set of rules for how they wanted the machine to perform. Now, in that situation, what you might not know in advance is how good is it going to be. You build it, and then you test it and see. But you're not likely to be surprised by the kinds of things it can do. It's just going to play chess. It's not going to up and decide one day to go write a poem. It's not designed to do that. Fast forward to today, where we have these foundation models that are trained on massive amounts of data. So large language models are trained on a good chunk of text on the internet, and you know, around a trillion words or so. So huge data sets, and embedded in that data is a whole wide variety of tasks. There are scripts for podcasts. There are poems and screenplays and emails, and there's chess games because there's chess notation on the internet and computer programming and scientific papers. And the AI model kind of scoops all this up and is trained on this and ends up identifying patterns. And one of the things that researchers have found is that as you scale up to larger data sets, larger AI models with more connections in the neural networks and larger amounts of computing power, you can reach these tipping points where all of a sudden the model goes from not being able to do something at all to being really, well, usually like okay, and then pretty good at it very, very quickly. And they can't predict this in advance. And so you can have a circumstance where as you're moving up at the frontier of AI development, to larger and larger models. You're throwing more data and more computing power into this giant vat that kind of gets swirled around and the model gets trained on. All of a sudden, you're like, oh, wow, we didn't realize it. The model is now able to do X. And most of those things are great, but some of them could be scary. Things like writing malware or helping to create biological weapons. And so that's sort of like the why should we worry at the frontier of AI? And I'll just give you one real example. Recently, at the current frontier, and this is not true for older large language models, but the newest, most capable models, they have the ability to engage in strategic deception. They lie. They lie spontaneously when it's in the interest of that model to do so based on what it understands to be its goals. And that's not something that happens at smaller scales. And so that's the kind of thing that kind of, you know, is a little bit unsettling and is the kind of thing that we want to be concerned about.
Yeah, it would also be very upsetting to the aliens in Three Body Problem who have a problem with lying and deception. But, you know, it seems to me like, you know, there's sort of three categories of problems associated with frontier AI. One is what I would call human-like behavior, where they do things like human beings, but they're doing it on their own. The other is what I would call human-plus behavior, where they're doing things better than human beings, and we have to rely on them going forward because they're the ones developing drugs faster than we can develop drugs, or they're the ones solving these big complex problems. And then there is human-less behavior, and that is behavior that they just go off on their own to do. You know, this is the post-singularity behavior where they're making stuff up that we have been unable to think of. How do you rate the risks associated with those three buckets?
I would say that all of those could be fine if we can ensure that AI systems are safe and we can make them robustly safe. So if you think about all the things that you just described in the context of the Industrial Revolution, well, I got in my car this morning and drove into the office and the digital revolution, and we're talking over Zoom, over the internet right now. There's lots of things that we do on a daily basis that just wouldn't be possible without technology that enable, in some ways, superhuman kinds of performance, not in terms of intelligence, but in terms of, say, digital connectivity or processing of information or physically, you know, moving through the environment, lifting and carrying things. I think the challenge is that we need to be able to ensure that we understand how these systems function, whether it's a car or an AI system, and know that it's safe. And that's a real problem for AI systems right now. We don't really understand what's going on under the hood in these giant neural networks with trillions of parameters. So why does it do a certain thing? We don't have a good answer for that at the moment. That's something that people are working on. And we don't know how to make them reliably safe. So these models can be fine-tuned to refuse certain types of tasks so that if you go to GPT-4 and you say, help me make a biological weapon, it's going to say, I can't do that. However, people find ways to jailbreak these models to get around these safeguards. And once the models are released open source, these safeguards can be fine-tuned away very, very easily. And we see that when there's new open source versions that come out, within a day, there are uncensored versions of these models that are released. And so that's a real problem when we think about people potentially causing harm.
Now, one of the other big problems in this is that the regulators are not educated in it. It causes several problems. I mean, you know, you have a degree in physics, you worked in the military, you worked in the Department of Defense, you've immersed yourselves in these issues, and you go up to talk to people on the Hill, and I am sure that it is frustrating for you because you then have to go back to square one, take out a little children's book and explain, you know, what AI is for them. There are a few that have broken it. You know, Don Beyer, a congressman from Virginia, went to get a master's degree in AI, and Ted Lieu, a congressman from California, has a degree in computer science. And so there are few. And this is even a bigger problem in the developing world, where there are fewer people who understand these things. And the second half of the problem is that a bunch of sort of tech billionaires and AI companies have decided that they were going to step up and offer a helping hand to all these people. But of course, they're speaking to their self-interest. And so they can't be seen to be exactly objective because, you know, they're like, some of them are saying, hey, just look at extinction events. Don't bother with the day-to-day regulation of what I'm actually doing. That strikes me as one of the real big problems here, one of the biggest challenges associated with artificial intelligence is real ignorance.
Well, it is, a challenge, and certainly tech literacy is a challenge in Washington, and we've seen that over the last 15, 20 years with issues like social media and regulating the internet. And that's in some ways heightened with AI just because the technology is so new and it's moving forward so very quickly. I have been very impressed by the level of energy in Washington over the last year. There's been quite a bit of activity up on Capitol Hill and in the White House on trying to understand the technology. Certainly in the White House executive order, I think some really detailed and thoughtful guidance that came out last fall out of the Biden administration. And up on Capitol Hill, various types of hearings and forums that members of Congress are holding to get smarter on these issues. And at CNS, we do a lot of engagement with folks both on the legislative and executive branches on this. But I think it is totally reasonable to be skeptical of these companies, regardless of what they're saying. Now, there is this weird phenomenon where for years we've heard from tech companies, well, you don't want to regulate tech and you're going to constrain innovation. And now all of a sudden, some of the AI companies are saying, oh, you need to regulate us. And I think it's fair to also be skeptical of that. Like, well, what is their interest here? Why do they want to do that? That doesn't mean that some regulation might not be warranted. I'm inclined to think that some is. But we always want to think about, what are the incentives of the people who are making this case?
Right. Well, one of the reasons that some people cite for big AI leading companies to say, no, now is the time to regulate, is because they think it's going to lock in their gains and keep out other people, right?
Well, I think that's one of the big concerns. And the question is then, how do you structure regulations in a way that don't do that, particularly if the frontier of AI, where we're pushing forward into the unknown, maybe should be regulated, given that there is so much uncertainty about what the technology is going to be able to do. And there is potential risk of harm of things like models that could, help conduct cyber attacks or chemical and biological attacks. How do you structure regulations in such a way that don't also harm everyone else, the giant community of developers using open source models, using smaller models? One way that the executive order goes at this that I think is fairly smart is setting a threshold at computing power and basically saying, we're going to target regulations. Some regulations can apply in other areas that might be industry specific in medicine or privacy issues. But in terms of the frontier of AI, we're really going to target only the largest models with the most amount of computing power, which by default then narrows you to a very small set of companies and sort of exempts out the large majority of AI developers from that approach. And I think that that's a smart way to kind of give them space to run with it and then only focus on the most concerning models.
Yeah, although one of the flip sides that's associated with the acceleration of the development of AI that you've talked about, and you mentioned this in your report, is that the amount of compute that's involved, the computing power, is super expensive. It's super large. It's not available to a lot of people. And although the cost goes down, having first mover advantage for an extended period in the AI space does create the possibility that you have, I think you used the term oligarchs, but you have the term, you have companies that are dominant, and they could be dominant in ways that have huge social consequences. And I'm not just talking about killer drones. I'm talking about stock market. You know, that only a couple of players actually have the ability to be five moves ahead of everybody else, and they dominate the market, or, you know, dominating other kinds of markets, or having certain advantages in pharmaceutical development, or, and so forth. And so do you worry that this is a potential driver of inequality?
I think it's very much a concern. And we've seen this in the tech industry in the past with social media, with operating systems, where there is this concentration of power in just a small number of firms. And we're already seeing it with AI. Because right now, the amount of computing power and, frankly, the human talent that's needed to train the largest and most capable models is only held in a handful of companies that can train things right at the frontier of AI development. Now, one of the concerns there is that then you have other companies that are building apps on top of these models, but they're dependent on that provider. So, for example, OpenAI has allowed companies to build apps on top of GPT-4, but then if OpenAI decides one day, you know, we're not going to use that anymore, we're going to pivot off of that. You have this whole ecosystem that's reliant on that. And so that's why, one, open source is important, to create a vibrant, healthy open source ecosystem. And I also think there's a role to play here for the government to provide computing power and data resources to academics and startups through the National AI Research Resource, a sort of federally funded pool of resources that hasn't yet been funded, but the government is trying to stand up, that would help to level the playing field a little bit. It's not going to allow smaller companies to compete against some of the big ones, but it could help make these tools a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, I think a parallel, by the way, of that is that we need to make access to information about these developments available at schools of public policy, at the places we are training next generation leaders, so that they are prepared to grapple with these things. Not as an extraneous subset of high-tech issues, but as something that affects every area of public policy, where, you know, it's kind of like, I went to Columbia. We have the core curriculum there. The idea is there's certain things everybody needs to know. And to me, it seems like AI belongs in the core curriculum of policymakers going forward. Do you agree?
Well, certainly we all need to understand what these tools are and how to use them properly. Just like I think policymakers need to be savvy about the internet and social media and computer security. Certain people have said a lot over the last maybe 10 or 15 years that cybersecurity needs to be every CEO's concern for their company. I think all of that is true of AI as well. This is coming into every facet of our lives. And we're going to be able to use this technology more effectively and safely if we begin to start just understanding it. And I think that's going to take a lot of interaction with these systems to get a feel for what they can do and what they can't do.
Yeah, no question about it. And I'm certainly not arguing that everybody needs to be an AI specialist. My dad was a scientist at Bell Labs who was in the early days of the development of some of these technologies. And he would go out and give speeches, and they would say to him, well, that means everybody needs to learn computer science. And he would say, no, you're missing the point. The computer is going to do a lot of this stuff. What you need to do is you need to be able to operate literally in the world in which that takes place and understand how it connects to all the subsets of what's going on. Okay, look, you know, 30 minutes is not enough. I guarantee you, we will invite you to be on this podcast more often than you want to be, but please come back enough times. I do want to end, though, with one kind of, you know, out of left field question, because, you know, we've got an audience of tens of thousands of people who are really interested in public policy. And this podcast is going to have a lot of people who are especially interested in the AI of it. And they're going to be at different places along the spectrum. And one of the things about AI that, you know, can't be minimized is that it's just incredibly cool what is being done with AI right now. And so I want to, you know, start a bit of a tradition here and ask you, what have you seen recently that's blown your mind, that AI is doing.
Yeah, the video generation is truly mind-blowing to me. I think it's really impressive. That's something that has gone from just even 12 months ago was not very good and creepy and weird to OpenAI Sora is really amazing. And then the idea of AI-generated video games that are like adapting and generative in real time is just a wild idea. And I think it opens up, like, that's just the tip of the iceberg of so many possibilities of, you could imagine, interactive movies and other kinds of digital experiences where you have some AI system that's generating and evolving and changing as you're interacting with it. That's just a whole new way of interacting with computers that's quite exciting.
It also raises the possibility of the video game that's like the Hotel California. You know, you can enter, but you can never leave. You go in, and it keeps reinventing itself, and there's always a new level, and it's always challenges that are adapting to you. And you enter the game, and that's the rest of your life. You're just, right. you're just in there. But it is, you know, I mean, by the way, a subset of that is how it will change the arts and how people shift creative content. It's not just, oh yeah, we're going to create digital, you know, Robert Redford or something, and we don't need him anymore. It's that the creative process is going to change in ways that we can hardly imagine, which is extremely exciting. Anyway, Paul, it is a delight to start with you here. Congratulations on the great work you're doing. We really admire it. Follow it closely, and hopefully you will join us again sometime here on Scylla Consciousness.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to everybody for listening. There'll be a new episode of Scylla Consciousness each and every week in our lineup. You'll also be able to subscribe to it separately, and we hope you will. Until next week, I'm David Rothkopf for the DSR Network. Bye-bye.
This was Scylla Consciousness, a production of the DSR Network. Our producer is Riley Fessler, and our executive producer is Chris Cotnoir. For more information on the DSR Network and how to become a member, go to drnetwork.com.